And because I wanted to tell her story quietly and calmly with plenty of room to move, we will devote the rest of the program to my next guest, Janet Karpinski. And one of the reasons I want to do it is because I've long felt that she was, as I said earlier, pretty much the Bush administration's sacrificial lamb and allowed them to deflect a lot of criticism from up the chain of command. I'm sure that many of you will be familiar with Janice and her role as the former commander in charge of rebuilding the civilian prison system in post-Saddam Iraq, including, yes, the notorious Abu Ghraib prison. She was, and cop this, a brigadier general in the US Army Reserve. She was the first female general ever to command troops in a combat zone. And she had, by any measure, a pretty brilliant, I think, 25-year career. And until those photos revealing prisoner abuse at Abu Ghraib, she was still in her ascendancy. But that scandal ruined her career. But really only her career, because Janice Karpinski is the highest-ranking officer so far to be sanctioned for the mistreatment of prisoners. And she joins me now on the phone from her home in South Carolina. Welcome to our little wireless program.
It's so wonderful to be with you. Thank you very much.
Janice, I want, first of all, when I look at the cover shot, I realize that we all know your face very well. You know, as a result of this unfortunate sequence of events, you've become internationally known. I guess you would have preferred another road to fame.
I like to say that I was a stealth operator prior to Abu Ghraib photographs being released around the world. So being thrust into the spotlight was something actually that I was very unfamiliar with and tried to avoid.
But you're now weighing in with your book, aren't you? Because you think,
yes,
that you think you've been hard done by.
Yes, and not only that, but I am convinced more than ever, that not only me, but the soldiers, three of the seven soldiers that the president tagged as bad apples out of control on the night shift, three of them are still serving prison sentences. And I'm very quick to tell people I don't excuse their behavior, but there's many, many people who should be sharing those cells with them.
Well, let's unwrap the story in a nice logical sequence. But I want to begin with a quoting from your chapter, The Road to Baghdad. When I flew to Kuwait to join the brigade in June, we're talking of June 2003, 5 months after the first units had arrived, I was giddy with the sensations of being back in the Middle East. Though I arrived long after dark, that familiar blast furnace of dry desert air hit me as I stepped onto the tarmac. It felt like home. How could it feel like home? What was your previous experience of the Middle East?
I was in the first Gulf War. I was deployed as, again, one of the very first reservists to be deployed to Saudi Arabia during the first Gulf War, and I had the opportunity when I was there to go down to the United Arab Emirates to do an evaluation on whether a program to train the local women in the United Arab Emirates would work, if it was viable. I went down there and I did the assessment, took a look around, told them, made a report to them, told them what they needed to do. They said they could do all of that. And within a very short period of time, about a month and a half or 2 months, I was back in the United Arab Emirates to set up a women's military training program, and for the local women in the United Arab Emirates. And I stayed there after the completion of the first year. I stayed for an additional 3 months, and then I remained in the United Arab Emirates as an advisor for the continuation of the program.
And of course, your husband was assigned to Arabic language school when you were stationed at Fort Bragg, and you had a lot of friends with whom you passionately discussed just about every aspect of Mideast politics.
It's true, because at that time, and still in many ways today, but it's becoming somewhat easier, I think, but during the 70s and the 80s, there was, for me, it was an absolute fascination with the Middle East and the people of the Middle East and Arab people and their culture and their religion, and there were no opportunities in the military or as a civilian to really go to work in the Middle East. There were so many strict limitations for women.
Well, let's put the Middle East to one side at the moment and now look at you. You joined the army to get what the recruiting posters offered, adventure and travel. And here I'm quoting again, I wanted to do what soldiers do, like jump out of aeroplanes. And at the back of my mind was that shimmering schoolgirl vision of the pyramids. How come you did so well in the army? What did one understands it's not the most congenial place for a woman.
I think I did very well, number one and first and always, because I wanted to do well in the Army. And I loved being around soldiers. I loved the discipline, the environment, the military presented. It was a variety of challenges to me. And I know myself well enough to know that inside of me I have talents, abilities, and characteristics that would normally, and I use that word very cautiously, but normally be associated with men in the military.
Janice, did you ever have to overdo it? I'm trying to get to a little bit to your psychology here. To become competitive, to be on the cutting edge, did you have to be tougher than the blokes? And you can see where that question's heading in due course.
Absolutely. A long time ago, I remember reading, a saying on a T-shirt that says women have to do the things twice as good as men in order to be considered half as good. And I must have taken it to heart, subconsciously or consciously.
But did you ever do things twice as bad as men?
No, not that I can recall. I spoke up a lot. I never experienced a network of female military personnel who would, you know, support your suggestions or your initiatives. I was kind of out there on my own.
Mm.
I certainly tried to at least compete with my counterparts, whether they were male or female. And there were some times when I went overboard with that. And some people would say, you know, take a breath every once in a while.
But. Yeah, I've watched many women fail and succeed in the corporate world, in politics. It's always terribly difficult for them. But there you are in the first Gulf War and you get a Bronze Star. What was that for?
Well, I was, as I said, I was one of the first reservists to deploy, and the conditions that we faced for setting up the operations center in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, when there were Scud attacks occasionally, chemical alarms going off, and for the efforts that we made there, keeping new soldiers safe as they were arriving, getting them set up, it was a cumulative effort, and I was awarded the Bronze Star.
You, after 6 years in the United Arab Emirates training Arab women to be soldiers, you leave the regular army and you join the reserve army. Why did you do that, Janice?
I think it was at a time in my life when I made a declaration, actually. Before that, I said, if I'm not doing what I want to do just near the 10-year mark in the military, then I'm going to convert. I'm going to become a reservist or I'm going to become a civilian. But, you know, I felt like I was plowing things along, and women were certainly, not just me, but women collectively were plowing new ground. And it was still a very, very difficult direction. The people who were managing our careers, my career specifically, they were not willing to put us in those far more competitive assignments. So at that point in my military career on active duty, when I asked what my choices were for my next assignments, I was told, you don't want to fly airplanes. You don't want to go back to be with soldiers. You don't want to be with troops. You certainly don't want to go back on jump status, as if this person knew me very well. And he didn't. He was suggesting a variety. I could be an instructor. I could go to an admin position. I could go to supporting an operations center somewhere. But troop duty was pretty much out of the question.
Did you have a wider choice of options as a reservist?
I believed I did. I knew very little about the reserve components, but when I went for an interview for a possible position, the person who interviewed me was so encouraging, and this was an infantry colonel. He was so encouraging. He said, you know, the fields are wide open and more positions are opening every day for women in the reserves. I just jumped on it, and I thought that was, you know, it was meant to be.
I'm like most people listening to the program, a bit confused about the but the separations or the overlaps between the fully fledged military service, the reservists, and, of course, the National Guard have also been dragged into Iraq. How are reservists treated officially in the military hierarchy as a conglomerate?
Well, I will tell you, again, very naive on my part, but, you know, the National Guard is generally considered a state asset. The reserve components is considered a federal asset to deploy in concert with regular army military that deploys.
And, gotcha, yeah.
And after the first Gulf War, the reserve components really were given a better report. They were embraced far more affectionately by the regular army. It was as if they woke up that, you know, the reserve components really are different than they have been in the past. People recalled their recollections were mostly from Vietnam, where reserve and National Guard soldiers were considered second or third class.
Mm. So here's a woman who makes this decision. She's got background in the Middle East. She's tried to learn Arabic.
Right.
You know, you're not, in fact, culturally ignorant of where you're heading. Right. And you get this mission with the 800th Military Police Brigade.
Correct.
Would you describe to the listener what that was, that mission?
Well, the original mission was prisoner of war operations, prisoner of war, refugee, and internment resettlement. So if you police up during the course of combat operations, groups of people, because their towns have been blown away, blasted away, it was our responsibility to resettle these communities or of course, prisoners of war, the obvious. That mission was completed with that declaration of mission complete and victory on the 1st of May. But when I arrived there in June, instead of seeing my soldiers getting on planes to go home, we were assigned this new mission of rebuilding, restoring, and reopening all of the prisons for Iraq.
Now, of course, Saddam had opened all the prisons and released all the Iraqi prisoners at the end of 2002. So what did you discover?
We discovered there was not one facility that was not in almost complete disrepair. The looters had a field day in every one of the facilities.
So every light switch, every bit of cable, anything that had value was gone.
And to include the door frames, the cell doors, the iron bars on all of the windows, these were nothing. In most cases, they were nothing more than the concrete block left what used to be a prison facility.
And you had to get them up and running.
That's correct. And I had soldiers who were determined to do so. I really have to respect, I have tremendous admiration for what they were able to accomplish with very, very, very limited funding provided by Ambassador Bremer's headquarters.
Well, of course, you were assisting Bremer's headquarters with the coalition provincial authority, the CPA.
Right.
And here you are looking after POWs. Now, how different is that from looking after civilian criminals?
Well, it's completely different. Prisoners of war are the obvious prisoners of war. They are entitled to the Geneva Conventions. If the determination of their status, if they're spies or if they're from another country or if they're civilians, they're entitled to tribunals, Article 5 hearings, legal representation. They know the provisions of the Geneva and Hague Conventions. The Iraqi criminals that we were responsible for, now finding ourselves in all of these facilities in Iraq, are Iraqi criminals, and they are entitled to the law under their government. And because the Iraqi court system, the magistrate system, was completely dysfunctional at the time, not operational, the coalition law applied. And we were told by the senior legal person in Iraq at the time, and the judge who was working for Ambassador Bremer, to apply the Geneva Conventions to the extent we could and work on adding a visitation program, which, of course, prisoners of war would not be entitled to.
Now, Janice, of course, prisoners of war have different attitudes to prison. They've got different expectations.
Absolutely.
And I guess they've got the term Bush lawyer would come to mind. They pretty much know the ropes that they could expect.
And they know when the war is over, they'll go home.
Okay.
And and they did, where Iraqi criminals are much like criminals anywhere else in the world. They don't know what they are going to be charged with eventually. They don't know how long a sentence will be issued to them from the court. So they have 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to plan, to try and escape, to make life miserable for the guards that are mm-hmm. protecting them. So the mindset is completely different.
You were never happy about the location of Abu Ghraib as the main detention facility, were you? Why not?
Well, for two reasons. Our plan, we put together a plan to use Abu Ghraib only as an interim facility. It had 60 acres of real estate inside this 20-foot-high wall that surrounded 98% of the grounds of Abu Ghraib. The one location on the wall had been breached, but it was repaired with concertina wire, et cetera. But we used it because it could hold prisoners until the other facilities were ready to accept them. So it became like a holding area until transfer was possible. But because of its notoriety, we never wanted to use Abu Ghraib for a long-term facility. Besides that, from a military perspective, it was located in the middle of the Sunni Triangle. And
oh, right.
It was never a place to hold prisoners or run any kind of detention operation whatsoever.
I understand that we're talking about 260 acres surrounded by rubble, blown up vehicles, you know, a completely shattered landscape.
Right. And the area across the street, the main road that went from downtown Baghdad to other parts of Iraq, cut right through the middle of the Sunni Triangle, in fact, this main route, the other side where this was this acreage that belonged to Abu Ghraib when it was operational as a prison facility. It was farmland, but there were these towers located there where presumably the guards would have been watching the prisoners farm. And those towers became the firing points for some of the people that wanted us very much to be gone from Abu Ghraib.
This is LNL on ABC Radio, National Radio Australia, via ABC Online and, of course, MP3. And I'm talking to Janice Karpinski, the commanding general of Abu Ghraib and 17 other prison facilities. How did that work? How could you look after 17?
Well, we had 17 prison facilities. More than 40,000 prisoners passed through our system when I was in command of the 810th MP Brigade. And they were located all over Iraq, as far north as you could go, as far east as you could go, and as far south as you could go. And we had seven in and around Baghdad alone. So I was on the road a good 75% of my time.
Okay. What was your relationship with General Ricardo Sanchez, who was the head of the coalition forces in Iraq? I understand that it was less than cordial.
It was terrible. It really was. From the first time I met him, when I first got into Iraq and we made a whirlwind tour, an orientation tour, my predecessor took me to all of the locations. And he never met General Sanchez before, so he wanted to introduce me to him at the same time as meeting him. And General Sanchez, even though he knew that I was the incoming commander, he refused to acknowledge me. And he was directing all of his questions at my predecessor.
Mm.
And
Is this sexism in your view or something?
Absolutely. General Sanchez felt insulted by the fact that he needed to rely on a reserve and National Guard brigade to do this very critical mission. But he was further insulted. His warrior ethos was insulted because the commander was a female.
So that was your chain of command. He was effectively your boss and he didn't want to know about you.
That's correct. And he never let us in. He never welcomed us. I didn't expect flowers and flags waving or anything else, but I certainly expected support from my headquarters, and we never received any support from him.
Look, we've got a lot to cover, and we haven't got much time, so let me sort of compress the next bit. By the end of September, you had more than 3,000 prisoners. End of October, over 6,000. I mean, the numbers are just growing and growing. What happened with the security detainees arriving at Abu Ghraib? What sort of interrogations had been going on?
Well, at the time, we didn't know that any interrogations were going on anywhere except at Abu Ghraib, and then it was on a very, very... comparatively, there was probably two interrogations conducted in a week before the security detainees started to arrive, And then immediately, almost overnight, the military interrogation teams find that they're conducting dozens of these interrogations without any additional resources. And up until that point, of course, at Abu Ghraib, the only prisoners that were transiting the facilities were these Iraqi criminals that weren't being subjected to any interrogation. So this was a new pattern of behavior.
One of the things I found really alarming that's come out of Iraq is the realization that so many jobs are being outsourced to private contractors, and it would seem this included interrogation.
Absolutely. Now, interrogations were separate and apart from my responsibilities, which did contribute to the enormous problem that eventually developed. But when I saw the pictures for the first time, I asked the commander of the Criminal Investigation Division, who was showing me these pictures, I said to him, why are the translators in the cell block there with the prisoners? Why are they with the prisoners like this? And he said, ma'am, those aren't translators. Those are contract interrogators. Mm. And I said, contract interrogators? Where did they come from? And he said most of them came after General Miller's visit in September of 2003.
Ah, General Miller. Well, let's stop the narrative and introduce him to the listener, because he arrives at Abu Ghraib in August 2003, the commander of Guantanamo Bay. And right. He's sent to your bailiwick to review prison interrogation procedures and says he's going to gitmoise the operation. What did you take him to mean by this?
Well, when he made that comment, he'd already had the opportunity to explain to the military intelligence personnel that the operation down at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and he said, you know, the soldiers referred to it as Gitmo. He said it's very precise, it's very disciplined. The prisoners down there earn everything they have, to include a change of color of their jumpsuits. And he said that he intended to make Abu Ghraib the interrogation center for all of Iraq. He was going to gitmoize the operation.
Mm.
And to me, that meant he was going to extend his procedures at Guantanamo Bay to Abu Ghraib specifically.
Now, Miller has agreed to testify in a court-martial of Sergeant Cordona on the use of dogs. What do you think he will say?
Well, I think General Miller has already established a policy of not telling the whole truth. It's not exactly that he could be accused of lying, but he doesn't give any more information than is absolutely necessary to answer the question. Under testimony in June of 2004, when he was testifying before the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee, every one of those individuals, Sanchez, Miller, Cambone, Rumsfeld, everyone that testified about the photographs said that they did not know anything about the photographs. But nobody asked them if they knew about the techniques being used in the photographs.
A much more profound question, and one that has been much discussed on this program as we've looked at the whole issue of torture and the origins of some of these techniques. Janice, so where were you when you first saw the photos?
I came back to Baghdad. When I first heard about this ongoing investigation, I was not in Baghdad. I returned the next morning, went directly out to Abu Ghraib, and could not find anybody who knew anything or any of the details about this ongoing investigation. Some of the soldiers said, yes, they've been questioned, but since they didn't work in cell block 1A, they didn't know anything that they were looking for. And it was not until the 23rd of January, late at night, when the same Criminal Investigation Division commander brought the photographs to me to show them to me for the first time.
So you argue that you're as shocked by them as we are.
I absolutely was. I mean, my head was spinning. The room was spinning out of control. I thought, what in the world are they thinking?
But you can understand why people around the world would be skeptical about you saying this.
I do.
How could you not know is the sort of the knee-jerk response?
Well, I think that that's fair, because from the very beginning, when the first time that people around the world were shocked by these photos, the only name that was used in conjunction with them was mine. They'd show footage of me at Abu Ghraib as if it were my only prison facility, and as if I had not only just been there, but endorsed this behavior.
What, Janice, what do you make of, what do you think of soldiers like Charles Grainer and Lindy England? How do you react to their behavior?
I react to their behavior with the same shock that anybody else would. However, having been there on the ground in Iraq and specifically at Abu Ghraib, I understand how these soldiers may have allowed themselves to follow these instructions. I don't believe that it was simply wake up one morning and decide that this is what you're going to do, go and abuse prisoners or take advantage of them. I believe it was very incremental. It was methodical. It was by design. These contract interrogators who were sent to cell block 1A applauded their efforts by leaving the lights on all night, then applauded their efforts by playing loud music at different times of the day, setting these conditions for effective
Look, they've got 20, 30 years of rehearsal. This is something that's now pretty well established. But these soldiers would have been well aware of the Geneva Conventions. Why didn't they come to you with information about what they'd been ordered to do?
Well, I don't know, because I've never had an opportunity to speak to any one of those soldiers, as I was told by the same legal advisor to General Sanchez when I tried to get access to these soldiers to ask them what were they thinking. I was told they didn't work for me. They worked for the military intelligence commander, so I did not have any right to get in to see them. But I think from their
I find that extraordinary that you've been kept away from these people, because right? Your career has gone down the toilet as a result of this, and surely you've got every right to rigorously cross-examine all the players.
The way our judicial system works in the military, the way it's supposed to work, is a commander at the first level, the company commander in this case, or the battalion commander, they would have had the opportunity to review the evidence, make a decision, and perhaps eventually recommend it up to me for a court-martial or for stronger disciplinary action. But it never went that way.
Well, what did happen instead is you get targeted. The investigation into prisoner abuse led by General Antonio Taguba faulted your leadership, found that you hadn't properly trained or monitored your troops. You accused the army of making you a scapegoat. But what responsibility do you take for what happened?
Well, I do take the responsibility for those soldiers. I can't talk about their training because they were deployed long before I got there. I can't talk about what they knew their assignments. They were very familiar with the Geneva Conventions. I can't take responsibility for what they were thinking because, as I've said, I don't know. Mm. But I'm not going to walk away from them, as everybody else has tried to do, to dismiss them as seven bad apples out of control on the night shift. Nothing could be farther from the truth.
You must be very bitter that Rumsfeld and the Pentagon hierarchy just sort of dumped on you and danced away.
You know, I refuse to be angry and I refuse to be bitter about this because I feel empowered by the truth. I've been telling the truth all along. I still believe the truth is going to prevail. It may take some time, but I don't know if that's, too idealistic. But
I think it might be. But to me,
the Secretary of Defense and Sanchez and Miller, they win if I become a bitter old woman, and I refuse to.
I want to leave this for a minute and come back to you as a human being. I want to know how it is that Janice finishes up or starts to have these military dreams of jumping out of aeroplanes and all the rest of it. What's your class background? Where did you come from? What are your origins in the great United States of America?
I came from what they refer to as the Eisenhower era, middle class America. I mean, my father was served in the military in World War II because he joined. The draft was, affecting everybody. He wasn't a career military person, but the picture of him that my mother held, in a box of mementos and special objects was significant to me.
Mm. And so you're a true believer, born into a military culture.
Yes, and doing what's right for the country, and believing that we all kind of have to pull our weight and make a contribution in a variety of ways, whether it's being a lawyer or a doctor or a teacher or a car driver or whatever it might be. But really believing that.
And what education did you have, Janice?
I graduated from college in New Jersey. I was a school teacher and decided that I think that education is still probably in my future at some point, it wasn't what I wanted to do at the time. I had unbridled enthusiasm for seeing the rest of the world.
Are you still, after all, as a patriot? Are you still a true believer? Do you think that what your country is going through is but a brief aberration?
I think, yes, but I think it's more than a brief aberration. I think that now is a critical point in our history, and because the United States of America has such a profound impact on the rest of the world, everything that we do or decide affects everyone around the world. So I think we have a tremendous responsibility to decide and do the right things. And right now, I think that we are in a terrible position in terms of making the right decisions that are affecting the rest of the world.
Very few people listening to this program would cavil too much with Gulf War One. Most of them could see an argument that Saddam Hussein's exercise in Kuwait was naughty. Mm-hmm. But, of course, although we signed up very rapidly for both missions, this country is as divided as yours over Gulf War II. Do you think that the worldwide unease, the worldwide criticism of the invasion was in any way a factor in the behaviour of your people? In other words, was there a little bit of the Vietnam syndrome going on here, knowing that that you're involved in a war which is not universally popular, which is judged by many to be a serious error?
Affecting the people at Abu Ghraib or affecting the people in the United States?
No, I'm talking about people under your command. Do you think that there was a sense that this mission might in some strange way be warped from the outset?
No, I don't think so at the time that I was there, because the soldiers were angry, but they weren't necessarily angry because they felt that this was the wrong war. They were angry because they'd been hijacked and held hostage there, contrary to what they were told when they originally left the United States.
That they'd be welcomed, yeah.
They left believing, and they were told repeatedly that they would be there for 6 months or less.
Mm.
So when they were assigned this new mission, and kept hearing the words 365 days boots on the ground, the effect has far more responsibilities with the Reserve and National Guard soldiers who they told their civilian employers that they'd be back in 6 months or less. They have apartment leases that are about to expire.
Yeah.
They have children that are in the care of family or friends that they believed would be there for 6 months or less. So this is a profound responsibility that was completely ignored by the Pentagon.
Okay.
So I think that the soldiers were angry, but they weren't thinking about whether this was the right war or not.
They felt they'd been maltreated. Yeah.
Right.
Okay, let's go back to the Taguba report. When it's completed, 17 soldiers and officers, including Brigadier General Janusz Karpinski, are removed from duty. 6 soldiers faced court-martials, possible prison time, on charges of dereliction, maltreatment, aggravated assault and battery. And Taguba says, specifically, I suspect that Colonel Thomas M. Pappas, Lieutenant Colonel Jordan, Mr. Mm-hmm. Stephen Stepanovich and Mr. John Israel were either directly or indirectly responsible for the abuses. Do you agree with that assessment?
I don't agree with anything in the Taguba report.
Not a word of it.
No, because he was told what to conclude. He that type of investigation, especially as critical as the investigation would become, is required to be done by an impartial individual. And General Taguba, as he admitted in an interview a year later out in California, he said that he was good friends with Rick Sanchez. They were neighbors in Washington, D.C. Their kids went to school together, so he was hardly impartial. And he was told by Sanchez and likely by the Secretary of Defense what the conclusions were they were looking for. And General Taguba, who was very interested in getting his third star, did what they told him to do.
That, of course, is absolutely standard procedure in both politics and the military, isn't it? You appoint someone to an inquiry knowing that you're going to get a desired result. Now, how far up the chain of command should attention go? I'm perfectly willing to accept that it's got to go a hell of a lot further than Brigadier General Janusz Karpinski.
Right. and it should go all the way up to Washington, D.C. Because if you apply like General Taguba attempted to do, now, and it's very important to know that he was never in Iraq. He was down in Kuwait or back at Central Command in Tampa, Florida during the course of the war. So he's trying to extract a situation as if there were no mortars going off, as if the situation were as comfortable as Tampa, Florida, which is, again, ridiculous, but it goes a long way to understanding how intentional some of these things were. But this needs to go all the way up to Washington, D.C. It needs to go all the way up, certainly, to the Pentagon, to the Secretary of Defense, his Deputy Secretary for Intelligence, Stephen Cambone, who was literally, you know, joined at the hip with Major General Miller, directing how interrogation should be conducted and other techniques that should be developed. And we know that the Secretary of Defense does not work in a vacuum, so that he reports to the Vice President in conjunction with going to the President.
Well, Janice, you must have been reading masses of material on all this since you've been back, and you'd be aware of the Seymour Hersh essays in New Yorker, which really nails the administration, and in particular the aforementioned gentleman who likes to stand at his desk, he says, for 8 hours a day. So what's wrong with a prisoner standing, being forced to stand for a mere four? I mean, that must make you very angry.
It does. It gives me great concern, because our government has always been very willing to criticize itself, to allow dissent, to allow discussion. And this particular Secretary of Defense issued the instructions very, very covertly via rejection of, you know, previous Chief of Staff of the Army, General Shinseki, and brought in his own team. If you don't understand what I'm telling you to do, I can bring in a replacement who will.
My way or the highway, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And General Miller, in fact, made that statement to me when he was talking about wanting me to give him Abu Ghraib to make it the interrogation center. He made this declaration to me: we can do this my way or the hard way, as if we were on opposite teams.
Well, in many ways, many serving officers, many very senior people in and around the Pentagon have been on opposite teams to Rumsfeld.
Well, absolutely, but the ones that are still serving have been directly or indirectly cautioned. If you speak out against the Secretary of Defense, you will find yourself out on the street, or far more likely these days, in a courtroom facing mutiny charges. So they're not willing to do it.
Are you seriously suggesting they'd play it that tough?
Oh, absolutely. When you want to keep people, senior people, silent, look at the impact that those eight general officers wearing 2, 3, and 4 stars, eight of them gathered together after retirement to speak out truthfully about this Pentagon and this Secretary of Defense.
It was a remarkable moment, wasn't it?
Yes,
and
it
for
was.
10 minutes, America sat up and took notice, but now I think it's been forgotten.
Because the general officer, good old boy network, kicked into high gear and made numerous phone calls and contacts with each one of them, I am certain, and said, you know, this isn't right, and you have an obligation to all of us, and, you know, my phone is ringing off the hook, and how can I put my career and my family on the line to speak out? Tell the truth. That's what this country is all about. That's what's supposed to be part and party of a democracy.
I'm surprised that you can say to me, I was going to say run the line, that sounds as though I suspect your sincerity, that you can say that you don't harbour any bitterness. I mean, heavens above, woman, how can you not?
Because I believe in this country. I do believe in a democracy, and I think that people are now getting smarter rather than being complacent as they were perhaps in 2003 and 2004. I think more and more Americans now are saying, hold the phone. You know, all of that agreement, all of that complacency before, you might as well reverse that, because I don't forgive you for this war. I know more now. I know that you lied about the intelligence. There never was any WMD. You know, I want to go back to the beginning and say I don't agree with any of it, and you no longer have my support. Well, we can't go back and change history. So people are now getting smarter, and they're resisting more and more.
Janice, thank you for your time. You've been listening to Janice Karpinski. The book is One Woman's Army. The Commanding General of Abu Ghraib tells her story, and as you can hear, she tells it pretty damn well. The book is published by Hyperion in New York. Janice, thanks for your time.